Thank you so much, everyone. It's a wonderful welcome as usual in this great organization. Thank you again for having me once again. And this book is an interesting book that we're covering, and what I try to do is just pick up on some of the topics and aspects that he talks about in Chapter 8, and I will cover that from the Islamic perspective and hope that I will shed some light on that. I grew up in Santa Barbara actually most of my life, ever since I was about 7 years old. And I studied Islam from different teachers, and a couple of my teachers actually just became the first full accredited Muslim college here in the U.S. this week. And it's called the Zaytuna College. So Hamza Yusuf Hansen, who is my primary teacher and one that I benefited from a lot, I really love his perspective on Islam and his approach. And he is a global leader and works with another great scholar from Saudi Arabia spreading true Islam throughout the different parts of the world. And this is what I try to do in my own limited opportunity here in Santa Barbara. But I feel I have a great advantage. A lot of people don't, which is I have a pretty good audience and I have a very nice city. So I consider the city of Santa Barbara my city. It's a lot easier. Recently I was on a panel at Westmont College with some professors, and we were talking about how Islamic is the Islamic State in Iraq. And a gentleman that was there is a professor at UCSB. He came to me, and he's a Muslim, and he said, "You got it really easy." I said, "How so?" He said, "I've done debates in Texas. I've had people yell at me saying, 'You're wrong, go back,' that kind of thing." And the worst thing, I mean, the questions were very civil and very beautiful. And, you know, and I love that people really are sensitive to making sure they don't offend anyone. And I don't mind questions on our faith on any matter at all, but it's just nice to see that courtesy. So I wanted to mention that briefly. And reading most of this book, I'll be honest, I didn't read the entire thing, but I read most of it. There's a couple points that I wanted to speak about. One, I feel that I started practicing Islam when I was about 18 years old. And looking at this, I feel myself to come to a religion to analyze it, to look at it, to reflect on it, and decide if I want to follow this religion. My teacher was American. And I'm glad that was, because I could relate to him and ask him questions, and he was a convert, and I'm coming out of high school and really trying to decide what I'm going to do in life, and there were things I was doing that is not so-called Islamic, so I'm going to make sure if I'm going to dedicate my life to something, it better be true or convincing to me, otherwise I'm not going to waste my time. So I told him very clearly, I said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to follow this just because my parents are Muslim. I don't believe in that type of ideology. I think if it doesn't make sense to me, I'm not going to follow it. So what's your proof about it?" That's what I asked him directly. I said, "Don't tell me it's faith. I want to know. Proofs. Give me proofs." He smiled at me and he said, "The proofs are many, but you'll have to discover them as time goes on. We'll talk about them." Until today, when I experience something in my life that strengthens my faith, I always think of him. And that smile he gave me when he said, "The proofs are many." I think when I read this book, and at times when it talks about Islam or Muslims, some of it I can't really relate to. I'm not sure exactly what he means. Maybe it's his, Samir's experience with other Muslims. Of course, he comes from Croatia, Yugoslavia, which, you know, had a tough time, just like a lot of Afghanis over the Russian invasion, the communists, and the hardships and trials they had. A lot of times it's we learn the religion from certain cultural aspects or certain beliefs that people may hold. Today, what I'm going to try to do is present to the best of my ability the classical view of Islam as a religion. I'm going to try to keep my political thoughts out as much as I can until maybe Q&A. But I would like to look at some of the things that he talks about and then try to see how Muslims, we actually speak about this. And one of the things about it is, which is, what is faith in general to a Muslim? What is faith and how does one convert in Islam? as we know in chapter 8, he talks about his story of being baptized, and that was such a experience for him that he couldn't quite put in words, but that really affected him. And we have something similar in Islam. Water is a very important element in Islam. Water is looked at as a purifying agent. It purifies you to be able to pray. Without water, you can say that you cannot hold divine conversation with God unless you wash yourself. There's a story of the Caliph Omar when he was very upset at the conflict in Mecca in the early stages of the prophetic mission, in which he went into his sister's house and he was upset that they had converted. And if you recall or if you've read, Mecca was idol worshippers, and this was a society really built on worshipping 360 gods. So he was very upset that his sister had converted and believes in one God. So he came in and he was so upset and he wanted to read what this Quran was. So he said, "Give me that, let me read what you've written in these manuscripts or some parchment that they had written on. Let me read it." She said, "You can't read it until you wash yourself because you're not pure." So he actually washed himself. And this washing, actually, there's another element to it, which is it not only purifies you, but it calms you down. The Prophet Muhammad gave some advice on anger management. And we all need it at times. I have three kids, and I mentioned this last time. At times you need anger management. You know, it's actually a lot of times you need anger management. If you have a spouse as well, you need more anger management. So the advice he gave, which was, when you're conflicted or you've come to become angry or something upset you, you should say, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim." I seek refuge in God from the devil. Because they said anger is from the devil and produces a type of heat in you and you become very upset. He said, if that doesn't work, sit down. Just calm down and sit. If you don't sit, and if you sit down and it's still not working, lay down. And if laying down doesn't work, then go and wash. Purify yourself with water and then go pray. And I don't know if anybody's really, really been angry, but it's hard to get to a lot of those early stages. What often you might do is just walk away, which may be another very good example. But water is a very important element. When one does convert, and I'll talk about that process, one of the first things that one does right after is they'll take a shower, what is called ghusl in Arabic. And ghusl was to make sure water penetrates and touches every part of your natural skin, such that the legal scholars say if you're wearing nail polish, you need to remove it, because water needs to touch every part of your natural body. And after this, you are now in a sacred state. And this sacred state is called tahara. And tahara is a state of purity, in which actually Muslims believe all sacred scriptures you should not touch unless you are in this sanctified state. If you use the bathroom, or if you bleed, or anything like that, it breaks this sacred state. So when I read that he went in and became baptized, there is an important element in water for Muslims as well, and encouraged right after conversion, but also when they pray five times a day, in particular on Fridays. Fridays is the most sacred day to the Muslims, and in this day, all Muslims are required to take a very thorough shower to make sure that they are clean, both physically, but their shower is not complete if they didn't have the intention to become sanctified. So if they just took a regular shower and came out, it doesn't work, according to three of the four legal schools. So they say that, no, you had to have an intention to become in this state. And it's amazing because as a Muslim, I practice Islam and I feel at times, am I in a state of purity or not? You feel different. You feel when you pray, you feel different. When you recite the Quran, you feel different. When you recite praises of God, you feel different. It's a state of being. And so that's one thing I wanted to touch upon. Faith to the Muslim, what is called Iman, comes from a word in Arabic called Aman, which means safety. Therefore, when we have faith, and I'm not sure in English all the roots of where faith comes from, but in Arabic, Iman, it has to do with taking safety. securing yourself, bringing about yourself tranquility, ease, understanding, a type of calm and peace in your life by accepting a reality. Therefore, you achieve a certain state. And that's what faith is. That's what Iman is. And Iman, the Prophet was asked, what is faith? He said, أَن تُؤْمِنُ بِاللَّهِ وَرُسُلِهِ وَكُتُبِهِ وَمَلَائِكَتِهِ وَكُتُبِهِ وَرُسُلِهِ وَالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ. To believe in God and the existence of His angels and His prophets and the divine books that He sent down to different prophets and the last day, and to believe in a predestiny. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit throughout talks, because there's some things that Samir mentions in his book that relates to how Muslims view the world, which is a type of predestination. And obviously with angels and prophets, these are things everyone is very familiar with. We have those concepts in the Bible, and the Muslims acknowledge those to be realities as well. Most of the prophets in the Quran are also prophets mentioned in the Bible, such as Zechariah and John the Baptist and Jesus and Moses and Elijah and Ezekiel and on, different types of prophets that are mentioned, but just with the Arabic pronunciation. Like you have Noah, in the Arabic it's Nuh, you know, so there's slight variations in the pronunciation. I asked one of my teachers at one time, and Muslims were confused about this, about the Arabic language, and this is a tangent, but just a brief one. Whereas Moses, there's a lot of quote between him and God speaking in the Quran, and Muslims often think Moses did speak in Arabic with God. So they're actually confused when they learn it wasn't Arabic. It was Hebrew and the language of Moses. But what the Quran tells us is the meanings of what was spoken. So I've had this discussion with Muslims, and they said, but how can that be? I said, because most of the Arabs were not, most of the prophets were not Arab. And actually, the language of the Quran is not even the language of the divine speech and legal and theology of the Muslims. They say God speaks without language, without letters, without sounds, without anything that resembles human speech as we know it. So Muslims believe when God spoke to Moses, He spoke to him complete in a way that is divine-like. What is divine like? Well, give me another divine so we can compare it to divine like. Since we don't have that, we're not able to define it. And as Karen Armstrong would say, once we define God, we define Him. We give Him limitations. So anyway, this is one thing about converting. Once faith settles in the heart and one truly believes, then one acknowledges that with the tongue by uttering, there is no God but God. And some of what Samir talks about to me as a Muslim rings true of the first statement. La ilaha. There is no gods with a, you know, small g. Idols, things we set up. And this is what he calls it, but he even talks about religion to be an idol. And I can agree and disagree on that. And I'll talk about that. But la ilaha means there is no one really worshipped illallah, except God, truly worship, meaning in reality. And that's something that it comes from faith and it comes from acknowledging. So when he speaks about that, it's really all about God and it's this is our focus, I could agree with that, because idols are set up. You know, in Islam, in the Quran, there's different idols that are given. Passions and desires are equated with being an idol in the Quran. There's a verse that says, have you not seen the one who took his passion and desire to be a god besides God? Right? So, what do I mean by that? Well, we have serious problems with addictions to different things that started innocent but led us astray. Especially amongst youth, especially amongst many others, that a lot of things start off innocent but then they end up harming the individual. And at times they need professional help. It's not just repentance and coming to church or a mosque and then saying, I'm going to be a good person now, or I'm going to stop this. It doesn't often occur. You need professional help. So, la ilaha illallah. Although the classical scholars say you don't need to utter that actually, as long as you believe in your heart the reality of God. But the Muslims would add the Muhammad Rasulullah, that Muhammad is the messenger of God. And this is what, and with Muhammad Rasulullah, there is a universality that what we're also saying is Jesus is the messenger of God, and Moses is the messenger of God, and Abraham is the messenger of God. In the more deeper theology of books of theology in Islam, you read that what is in that statement, Muhammad is the messenger of God, is also implicated other meanings as well, such that if a Muslim does not believe in any of the existence of these prophets, then it's not complete. And I still meet people that ask me, do you guys worship Muhammad? And I'm a little shocked, and at the same time I wonder, Muslims haven't done a good enough job to present Islam and to invite people to the reality of Islam. I said, no, we actually don't worship any human being. We believe that Muhammad was a prophet that did purify humanity, that did guide them to what is right, etc. But we don't worship him. He's a messenger, a human being, like other human beings who came before him. Because they, at times they feel, oh, you know, I don't want to say anything against Muhammad. But if you say anything against any prophet, it's actually hurtful to the Muslims. We see the cartoons about Muhammad popping up in the media, and you see Muslims have a frenzy. But at the same time, it's actually anything that's said about any of the prophets, whether it be Jesus or Moses, it's supposed to be the same in terms of sacredness, in terms of respect, not just about Muhammad, but about any of the prophets of God. Of course, how Muslims react, I disagree with that. That's not the way to react. It's not civil. It's not the way the prophet would have wanted it. There's people that have tried to kill him, assassinate him in his life. He forgave them. He pardoned them. He, you know, talked to them. Why is it what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? So that's very alien to the response we see from so-called Muslims in our world today. Another topic he brings out is, what does one gain from following Jesus Christ? If you recall that chapter or that topic. And I ask myself that question, what do Muslims get out of following Muhammad? What did I get when I decided to follow Islam? I like what he said when he mentions that there's not a guarantee of a good life. Not necessarily. You get what you get. It may be good. It may not be good. This is also true in Islam. We say by following Muhammad in the teachings of Islam or in the previous generations of the prophets, you're doing something that was your purpose of creation. God created, the Muslim belief is that God created you to know Him. How can we know Him? The Muslims say the philosophers are limited in their knowing God. Why? Because the human intellect can only arrive at a certain amount of knowledge of God. And the proof of that from the Muslim argument is, well, we've had hundreds of philosophers with hundreds of views. Reality must have a certain truth to it. We cannot all come to this room and we decide different things on what's really taking place here. You know, and they're very drastically different. For example, it's Yama. No, it's not Yama. It's someone else speaking. Actually, it's no one speaking. It's just sounds being created. We're not sure where it comes from. Muslims believe there has to be a central unity. And therefore, in this purpose, by following the Prophet Muhammad or following a prophet, only they know what God wants because they were directly experiencing God. And in this argument of the Muslims, only when God directly communicates with one of His creation do we know exactly who He is. Or when I say He, I don't mean male, as Muslims don't believe God is male or female. It's limited language. We don't know exactly God, what God is, what He wants, why He created us. And often we, in our mind, expect God to be good. But at the same time, have we really thought about, is it possible or conceivable that we could have lived in a world where it was not so good, or God could have created us to do whatever He wants, and really could anybody have objected? Of course, I'm not saying this is the reality, but it's conceivable as an idea. So because a lot of times when I speak to someone who's an atheist, and the arguments they bring are all already pre-expectations of what they want God to be, what they expect from God. But you see, the reality is we are existent and we are here. And only things, as he mentioned, life is what we witness, then we also get to know God from what we are witnessing. And that's part of what Muslims believe the Shahada is, declaration of faith, is what you are witnessing in creation. Creation becomes signs and symbols of God. So in following any of the prophets, you're fulfilling a duty and a what we call a maqsad and a purpose for what you're created for. And yes, maybe you will have an easy life, and the Quran, it does mention, whoever believes in God and does good, God will give him an easy life. What if it's not? I mean, you have the life of the prophets, and the Prophet Muhammad has a statement that the worst people in tribulation are the prophets, and then those closest to them in rank of spirituality, and then those closest to them. So if we look at Moses, look at how many tribulations Moses had. I mean, from the Quranic perspective, how he grew up from the very beginning. He lost his mother growing up in the house of Pharaoh, being thrown into the river, being from children of Israel who are being killed and persecuted by Pharaoh. And then he has to deal with growing up at a certain point of his life, 10 years in exile according to the Quranic or Islamic understanding. I'm not speaking on the Bible's half. And he goes through so much, and he gets married, and then he travels back to Egypt. And then at the age of 40, and a lot of people would like to settle down a little bit at 40. I mean, I'm getting at 40 and I want to settle down. I can't imagine starting a mission at 40. And then he has to go deal with Pharaoh, and he has to deal with the saving children of Israel, and then they get saved, and then he goes to the Sinai, and he has so much responsibility. And he had a tough life. And the same of the other prophets. You know, we have Job, we have Joseph and his brothers and his early life, and spending all that time that he could have just been with family, right? He could have just been with family. The reason why they had so much tribulation is because, again, from the Muslim perspective, it's not about this world. It's about the hereafter. And tying in this world to a greater world. It's like, as he mentions, one world at a time, but we would say that each of these worlds we're in has a purpose and a limited time and something you want to gain before you move to the next world. So if all those things that these prophets went through that were hardships and trials, on the Day of Judgment, Muslims believe in an afterlife and Day of Judgment, God will give them the greatest of rewards, the highest of all elevation and in rank. And it is in the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad that the worst person in tribulation in this world, when they just glance at paradise, just for a moment, they're taken out and they're asked a question. The worst person in tribulation in this world. Do you remember any tribulation in the life of the earth? They said, by God, I swear, I don't remember anything. I can't really recall. Maybe, I don't know. I don't remember any tribulation. What was it that they saw? What was it that they witnessed? This incredible reward for their patience through their trials. I mean, for me, when I look at life, I have to have that to exist. Because all the suffering in the world, if I as a Muslim or me as an individual, I'm looking at that this is life is it and there's no other life, it becomes tough for me to take that in and saying that there's no purpose, there's no justice. People can get away with murder. People can get away with everything that they do and not be held accountable. To me, it's not the understanding I want to embrace. So, and the person who was the most corrupt and committed a lot of evil in the world, as we might want to call it, murder, etc., they lived good lives, they had wealth, they had all these different things. When they see the punishment of God that is to wait, and they're shown just for a moment and brought out, meaning hellfire, they see it and they come out and then they ask the question, do you remember a day of good in your life? This is the person that had everything in the world, but they used it against the will of God, in the sense that they used it for not the purposes of gratitude or serving humanity or doing good with it. They used it just for corruption, their own passions, desires, and they were in the worst of state. They said, no, by God, I don't remember a day that I had good in this life. So when we look at this perspective, we kind of see that Muslims will often speak to each other in times of difficulty as لا بأس طهوراً inshallah. Don't worry, this is a means of purification. It will remove your sins. It will elevate your status. Be patient. God is with the patient. It is said that on the Day of Judgment, those that were patient against tribulation, against pain, against anything that you had in your life that really required patience, they're told on the Day of Judgment, stand up those who were patient. Go in that line straight to heaven. You don't even have judgment today. There's no judgment for you. It's a VIP line. Just go in, no questions asked, go. So they'll actually resurrect and go straight to paradise. They don't have to deal with any questioning, nothing. So from this we can say that patience. Okay, so one time a man asked God for patience. The Prophet Muhammad said, don't ask for that. And what happened is this person got a lot of illnesses. He went through a lot. And he became absolutely purified. All of his sins were out. Because Muslims believe whenever you have sicknesses or hardships or whatever, your sins fall off of you like leaves fall off of a tree. Such that the person is now sinless. So the Prophet Muhammad asked him, what did you do? He said, I asked God for patience. He said, don't ask for patience. You're going to become patient. Rather, ask for well-being. And this is the other thing, that God doesn't want us to go necessarily through hardships. He wants ease for us. But at times, hardship may be the only way you'll return to God. The only way you might remember God. As often the human being, if he's not thinking about God, and I see this when I fly, and everybody's really having fun and whatever, and the plane shakes a little bit, and everybody gets real serious. You know, and if you're religious, you'll pray. If you're not religious, you might think about religion. There's a, you know, and the Quran talks about this. When you're in the middle of the ocean and the waves come, then they call on God. مُخْلِصِينَ لَهُ الدِّينَ, making religion only for Him. Making religion only for God. Then it's all about God. And then at that point, human beings reach deep and say, I think if there is, and there must be, please help us. Whatever it is. I have a cousin who's not very religious, and he doesn't pray and stuff, and he was on an airplane and his airplane was struck by lightning, and I guess the airplanes are designed to take that. And he said, Yama, I prayed like I've never prayed. I said, how are you doing now? Because the Quran says once they reach land, then, you know, they forget about it. So this is the case, is that, you know, we often forget about God. And the Prophet Muhammad praised those who remember God in hard times, just like they those that praise God in good times. So they say, remember God in good times, so He remembers you in your hard times. You see, because it cannot be just every time you have trouble, then you go to church or you go to a mosque and ask for help. It's finals week. I tell this to my students and the people that come to our mosque. It's finals, they all show up to the mosque, right? They have finals coming, they're studying, but they want God's help a little bit. So the mosque is packed during the finals week, and then they'll be praying. And they might even come to the mosque at night in extra prayers. And they say, pray for me, I do well. And I always think in the back of my mind, as a Muslim, you should worry also about the day of judgment, that that's the greater test. And whatever happens to you in this world, I mean, you get an A or B, it's not going to be the end of your life. And yes, it's very important and you should give it every effort, but at the same time, you should give that which has eternal consequences more attention. Right? And I think Samir mentions that. And one of the great Sufis, Imam al-Alawi of this last century, he said, when I reflected and thought about all that waits in the eternal abode, into that which is the temporal abode, I thought to myself, why am I going to waste this temporal abode for anything other than the purposes of the eternal abode? Because this life will pass by us like a blink of an eye, and then we will have to then go to another abode that is eternal, so might as well make all the efforts. I call it like an hereafter bank account. This is what I tell Muslims. Deposit righteous actions in your here account, you know. And this is actually in the lives of the Prophet's companions. One time somebody visited one of the companions' lives, and they were very poor, the majority. They gave a lot in charity. Something that I would argue I don't see a whole lot from the community of Muslims today like it was in the early generation. They really used to give to those in need. The man spent the night at his house. He had no pillows. He barely had a blanket. He said, where's all your things at? He said, in my other house. I said, okay. Where's this? Where's that? There were so many things he didn't have. He said, in my other house. Later he found out that his other house he's talking about is the hereafter. And a lot of Muslims actually in the early generation, they strove not to involve too much themselves in the worldly pursuits because they said that the more we enjoy, the more connected we become to this abode until we don't want to leave. So the Sufi, actually, in the Islamic tradition, the Sufi is the one who lives in the world physically, but not spiritually. In other words, in the presence of his heart, he's always like a traveler. And I always think about this when I travel. I love traveling. Some Muslims and us, we were talking this morning about traveling. When you're at a terminal in an airport, it's an amazing metaphor for me about the hereafter. No one at the terminal takes the place as a permanent abode. I've never seen that. Okay, even the people who work there, they know they're going home. At an airport. You know, you're not going to have a full meal, right? You're going to miss your flight. You go, you grab what you can. You know what, I'll just grab a coffee. That's good enough. I'll get it later. You're not going to take showers because you really don't have time. You're just going to do the necessities before you move on. And everyone, there's planes waiting for everyone. And this occurred to me this last time because I had a really long layover and I was worried whether they'll hold me in the airport like they usually do with Muslims and particularly myself. So I cleared the lines extremely quick. So I had to sit in front of a gate for 2 hours in the morning. And I had a lot to think about. And this is one of the things I thought about. As I said, no one treats the terminal, the airport, as a permanent abode. And the Prophet Muhammad said, this is this world. This world and me, he said, my likeness of being in this world is like a traveler that stopped on a bridge, took a little nap, or just rested for a brief time and moved on. And he did this throughout his life. People would say, Prophet Muhammad, let us get you a bed you can sleep on. Why are you sleeping on straw mats? He said, this is not what I've come here for, the luxuries of the world. I am but a traveler. Aren't you happy that those things are waiting in the hereafter? Just be patient. He would often tell his companions. Of course, there's nothing wrong in Islam to having luxury. And you can see in the Muslim world, they've had a lot of this. As long as it doesn't take you away from your responsibility towards God, towards His creation, and as long as you don't do anything with that wealth to become corrupt. But the nature of wealth, once you get it, is you generally become more corrupt, or it can corrupt you. So a pure heart is going to be the one that's not going to let the wealth destroy you. So getting back to a few other points, there's a point that he brings that none of us chose life, or how did we choose life? Muslims believe in five stages of creation, that there's five lives or five different worlds, if you will. The first world already existed before this world, and that's called the world of the souls. And in Islam, the soul is one of the mysteries that God created. We don't know exactly what it is. We're not even sure if the soul is linked to our bodies directly, or they are, you know, we're not sure what size, we're not sure where they exactly reside. All we know is that we are connected to the soul, right? Because one of the things that fascinated me when I looked at Muslim writings on the soul, none of them said that which is attached to your body. But they say that the body runs by the power of the soul, right? So it is the soul that powers the body. Right? Just like a phone has the battery, if you take out the battery, there's no movement, right? It's dead. And so the body is powered and lives by the soul. That soul, we believe, is eternal. And for that reason, they say, some of the spiritual scholars, you can live 70, 80 years on earth and it will still feel like a blink of an eye. Because though our bodies may get older, our souls are still as young as can be. And they don't really age. And there's an experience that the souls will have and have had that we sometimes may have some access to it, but very faintly. So in this last world, all the souls were created and gathered, and then they were asked a question. Do you accept life? Do you accept responsibility? Are you sure you want to go to the earth and bear this responsibility? In the Quran it says the responsibility of judgment and what's called taklif, the responsibility of believing and doing good was offered to the mountains, the universe, and they all rejected it. And the Quran says, حَمَلَهَا الْإِنسَانِ, but the human being bore this responsibility. إِنَّهُ كَانَ ظَلُومًا جَهُولًا. Indeed, he was very ignorant and very oppressive. This is a hyperbole that means that generally, the most cases of human beings, they'll be either an oppressor or an ignorant one. That they will not. So these two things are very important, to gain knowledge and not be oppressive to yourself or towards others. So, but human beings bore the responsibility and they were asked, أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّكُمْ? Am I not your Lord? Do you accept this? And in the Islamic tradition, the first to answer was the Prophet Muhammad by saying yes, and all the other prophets answered. And then it went on to the rest of humanity. There's a group that quarreled. I'm not sure if I do want to go. There's a lot of stories written on this. If you're interested in this topic, there's an e-book I think you can get online. It's called The Lives of Man by a beautiful Sufi scholar from Yemen called Imam al-Haddad. And you can talk to me in the break. I can give you that. And then from that soul, that world, then we come into the wombs of our parents, our mothers. And as we are installed, actually, we are installed in the womb in the Islamic tradition and 4 months old. And the angel puts the soul now connected to the body. And this is when, in the Islamic tradition, life begins and permanence is established. Such that if that child dies at 4 months or 5 months, it will be resurrected on the Day of Judgment as your child. Of course, in Islam, our position is that abortion is impermissible, not allowed to. But in cases of rape or great harm to the human being, if they were to do so, they should do it in the early process before 4 months, because then at least there's no soul attached, though it is still not permissible. But because the trauma to the mother in cases of war, right? And there's a lot of women that were raped in some of the 90s wars, and we don't want to talk about that, but scholars gave a legal fatwa or an opinion that they're allowed to do that because of the trauma and etc. So, and then from this world, there's another world, which is the intermediary realm, and then there's the Day of Judgment, and then the permanent abode. So there's looked at as 5 stages. And another thing I wanted to talk about is, he talks about the map in reference to guidance or a manual, if you will. The Quran for Muslims is a very important book. And some of what he mentions, I disagree with, that, you know, religion in a way forgets God, or we're not in need of direct religion. I think one of the things for Muslims in particular, the Quran is everything for them. It is the absolute word of God. And there's a slight difference here with other faiths. To go to a Muslim and tell him that this verse of the Quran is outdated or this is not really relevant is to basically say God is wrong. And so they hold the Quran very, very dear, and at the same time the absolute word of God. But interpretation comes in play. That's where I would agree with them, that it depends on interpretation. And every corrupt thing we're watching on TV is because of the misinterpretation of the Quran. But another thing most people don't know, Muslims do not live only by the Quran. This is where they forget. The Quran is one source of guidance. The secondary guidance is the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, called his statements, hadith, sunnah. Unless the Prophet clarifies, we're not sure exactly what the Quran means. So he clarifies, and his life becomes an example of the teaching, such that his life demonstrated at times to not to overlook rules, but that everything has a time and place. So when we speak about, you know, the world as it is and the chaos and all the things we have to deal with, one of the things how Muslims deal with this problem of, you know, the text and relevance to our life as it is and when it conflicts is, in Islam there's principles and purposes, and these are branches in Islamic law that deal with what is called maqasid of Islam. Maqasid, which is the purposes of Islamic law, usul al-fiqh, which is the methodology of deriving these. And one of the things that that does is it looks towards those things that are difficulties, hardships, or I don't want to say no longer relevant, but needs a special touch, a reflection from the traditions of the Prophet, such that it is unique to our time. And this exists in Islam. It's more like a very dynamic approach that in America, for Muslims, rulings that were previously there are not exactly the same in application. They vary because of the need, because of the time, because of the change. And this is in the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad. One time, he joined 2 prayers for no reason. He prayed them together. And to give you a background, you need to pray in its own times. You're never allowed to join unless you're traveling. He joined without traveling and without rain. They said, there's no purpose to this. Messenger of God, why did you combine the prayers? He said, I didn't do it for you. I did it for those who come after me, that there will come a time that life will be so hard for them to pray on time, they'll take this as my example that they're able to join the prayer. Because unless he did it, you cannot take a precedence of that. He becomes the precedence of which we can use for example. If he never did it, it becomes very hard for a legal Jewish scholar to say, yeah, go ahead and do that because it makes sense to us. No, he must have done it. And so he did it, and that shows times change, rulings change, and things become harder. So therefore, one of the legal principles of Islam, legal maxims, they say, anything that becomes an incredible hardship, remove it. So for example, if you're dying of hunger or thirst, you can eat pork, you can drink alcohol, 2 things that are not allowed. For necessities, override rules. And this is one of the principles of Islam. So I don't see personally as a Muslim the conflict of how do we live in a pluralistic society and stay true to our text. I would say that the texts are there. What is required is somebody of intellect and correct understanding to bring out that text and show how we can live civil, peaceful, and in harmony. And we've done this in the past. It's not like we haven't done so. You know, Spain was Muslim for many hundreds of years and people lived in peace. You know, some of the conflicts we see in the world today doesn't mean that this is how it was or how it needs to be. Right? So it's there. Those that want to interpret the Quran as a book of hate and others, well, they're choosing what they want from it, and we can do that with all religious texts, just about. We can take things out of place and we can take them, and especially if you're dealing with uneducated, mostly groups, it's easier to manipulate and to brainwash and use it out of place. But to take it as a whole is different. So, sometimes he talks about destination, you know, where is it that we're going, the purpose of this life. There's a beautiful verse in the Quran that tells us what's our purpose, where we came from, and where we're going. And this is all in one verse in the Quran. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Verily to God we belong, and to God we are returning. That's it. So our place that we're going is... So the Quran, I think, is very important. That I don't think that any Muslim would ever say that the Quran is outdated, that yes, there are things in the Quran that are not applicable necessarily because the conditions don't meet. Just like in Islam, you cannot pray unless you wash, because that's a condition. You don't pray unless you're a Muslim, because that's a prerequisite of a condition to be able to pray salat, bow down before God, you must acknowledge God. If those conditions are not met, it's not obligatory upon you. It doesn't follow. Some of these verses in the Quran are taken out of place and not relevant because it doesn't meet the conditions of which the prophetic traditions have laid down. So it's taken out of place. And this is by most extremist groups, in fact all extremist groups and others, they take things out of place without applying the conditions of them. The conditions of various matters in your life, if you don't meet those conditions, you're not allowed to apply it. There's a point he brings, celebrating God and serving for the sake of God, not rewards. Muslims see the world, there's levels of one's righteousness in Islam. The highest level is to do things for the sake of God. In other words, were there no heaven or hell, you would still do it because you love God. This is often mentioned throughout the Quran. There's a story of the cousin of the Prophet, Ali, and his daughter, who was married to his daughter, Fatima. They were fasting for 3 days. Their child was sick. They made an intention, if our child gets better, we will fast 3 days of gratitude towards God. So their child got better and they fasted. The first day, they're about to break their fast with some water and some bread. They had very little amount of food. And someone knocks on the door, a poor person, wanted some. In fact, it was like a prisoner, and one day it was an orphan, and one day it was somebody poor. And each 3 days they do this. And in Islam, once the sun, before sunrise, the next day you fast again. So they fasted 3 days. All these 3 days, someone knocked on their door, they gave the only piece of bread that they had. So for 3 days, they only broke their fast with water. And in the Quran picked up this incident and mentions in the 76th chapter that they feed for the love of God the poor, the destitute, and the prisoner, not wanting any rewards. لا نريد منكم جزاء ولا شكورا. We don't want from you. This is speaking about their internal quality of their heart. This is not what they said, but what they were feeling in their heart. We don't want from you a thanks or a recognition or any rewards from you, from the poor and feeding them. إِنَّمَا نُطْعِمَكُمْ لِوَجْهِ اللَّهِ. We only did this for the sake of God. Okay, and وَجْهِ اللَّهِ means purely for the sake of God. So, when I saw that the he mentions that this is the highest, we would share in that and say that. But unfortunately, many people on their spiritual level are not at that position. They're not at that great level, and there needs to be incentives. So in Islam, when you say, what do you get out of it? You get Jannah, paradise. There's 7 levels. They're greater than the universe in its size. You can have anything and everything you want. It's a much more real life. In other words, there's no way it's going to be like this. This is looked at as the lowest of all levels of existence. All this is very limited. In the next world, you're rebuilt. You're reshaped. You're made into an incredible, beautiful person. With any desire, any want you have, you'll get. So, that to me... I'll be honest, it's worth going for. We won't lie. But the other thing is, the Quran doesn't exactly give you what is in the next world. And this is where people make mistakes. Because when I was studying this theology, I asked one of my teachers, because there was a line in classical theology of the Muslims, that all these descriptions in the Quran, including, you know, although the virgins is not directly described, it comes from a tradition that people have exaggerated on, but it mentions that all these descriptions, paradise, rivers running underneath, trees, fruits, they're all what they call ma'ani, just meanings, indications, gives you ideas to imagine. As for its reality, we don't know. What do you mean? You know, at that point I was really shocked when I was reading this, because I said, so then its reality is other than that? And he said, absolutely. And this is, you can read about this. This is classical theology of the Muslim. Because the Prophet said, in paradise, there is that which no eye has ever seen, nor no ear has ever heard of, anybody talking about great descriptions, nor any imagination of all of the humanity of 7 billion and all that existed has ever imagined such a magnificent place. Well, I don't know what could get you going, but this is an incredible idea of paradise, whatever it is you want. But then you think, what is it? How long is it? I know the idea of eternity is scary. Samir highlights that. But the way I look at that is that there is a recreation in paradise. So you're not going to... You know, in this world, eternity scares us. I mean, it scares me. Because you keep thinking to yourself, yeah, but what do you do after 1,000 billion zillion years? You know, there's got to be a time it all ends. It can't go on forever and ever. But Muslims believe it does go on forever and ever. In this world, that's something you cannot understand. Nor is it something you really, if you give a deep thought, you're going to be too happy about it. It's a really scary thought. But the way I deal with this is knowing that the recreation of humanity in the next world is one of eternal existence. And in fact, when Muslims talk about why you cannot see God in this world, they say because you're temporal. Once you're recreated eternal, then the eternal can see the eternal, but not the temporal able to witness the eternal. And we have stars in our galaxies that are so bright, they're millions of times brighter than the sun. We can't even look at the sun 93 million miles away more than a few seconds, because it'll burn our eyes and, you know, you can go blind. What about a star even that much more powerful? I mean, we cannot even imagine that. What about the creator of that star and the other billions of stars? What is that creator? But this is, the Muslims believe the highest pleasure of paradise is directly to gaze onto God. But all the theologists always make it very clear, but not in any way you can even imagine. Not in front of you, not behind you, not spatial, not directional. It's beyond description. Why? Because it's God. And whenever we talk about God, we cannot compare Him to anything we know. And this goes back to the beginning of the universe. What before the beginning of the universe, when Samir mentions we're all one at one point. Well, what was before this beginning? Right? Even scientists, when you look at the first, they measure even the millionth of a second after the explosion and how far it went. It's amazing science. What was going on 5 minutes before that explosion? I want everybody to think about that a little bit. What was going on an hour before? Okay, what made it go do that? Where did that come from? I mean, it couldn't have, could it have pre-eternally existed like that, holding all that energy? At a point, they say, is smaller than a dot in a pencil when you put it on your desk. That small. It started that small. Well, the answer is actually, and the Muslims would agree with this, is there was no time. Because time was in the package of the explosion. So 5 seconds before was irrelevant because time wasn't created. There was no creation. And the Prophet Muhammad stated this. He said, كان الله ولم يكن شيء غيره لا لا يكن شيء غيره. God was and there was nothing with God. So this is the existence. So in that beginning, then the exploding and coming, you know, This was an incredible creation, and to be honest, I lost my train of thought where I was going to go with that, which means it's good for a break time, and I'll take the Q&A after. Thank you.